Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard. The Inside Analog Photo radio program is all about the traditional photographic process. We talk about all aspects of analog photography, including the hybrid workflow. You can find out more information over at www.insideanalogphoto.com. And of course, Inside Analog Photo is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful. These guys have the coolest instant photography materials known to mankind. They have, of course, the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4x5, color and black and white. They have the Instax systems in the wide format, the Instax 210 camera and film, and of course the Instax Mini in the Instax Mini 7 and the Instax Mini 25, both in color film. Beautiful stuff. There's nothing cooler than instant photography. You get a print, because if you don't have a print, you don't have a real photograph. This is great fun stuff. This is great for art. This is great for business. This is cool stuff. You definitely want to check them out over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends over at Photo Publicist, providing worldwide publicity, strategic promotion, social media marketing, and business development for the photographer, turning photographers into celebrities. You can find out more information over at www.photopublicist.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab for the highest quality work known to mankind anywhere on this planet. Unbelievable developing, scanning, and of course, output on high quality Fuji Crystal Archive. Unbelievable cool stuff these guys are up to. And remember, you don't have a photograph unless you have a print in your hand, and you need to print your pictures. This is important. You need to supply proofs to your customers and even print your own work, because it's not about looking at it on a monitor. It's about holding a print in your hand. Definitely check these guys out at Richard Photo Lab, of course, at richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at DR5. DR5 Chrome Black and White Developing, that turns your black and white neg into, that's right, black and white chrome. Unbelievable stuff. www.dr5.com. Our friends over at Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com for the camera strap that will not slip off your shoulder, guaranteed bar none, the coolest strap around. Our friends at Iger Studios for the finest quality drum scans known to mankind, igerstudios.com. Our official media partner, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, for all things traditional photographic process on the web, www.apug.org. And our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.eastmanhouse.org. This week on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to be here with Dion Reynolds. Dion is a rural Nevada artist shooting these beautiful images on film, but guess what? He's using plastic panorama cameras. This is right, old Kodak Fun Saver single-use cameras back from the early 90s, and he's making these unbelievable handmade prints of rural Nevada places, ghost towns, sand dunes, crazy stuff, beautiful photography. You know, it just goes to show you, it's not the camera, it's the photographer. It doesn't matter if it's a $2 camera or a $20,000 camera. You can create beautiful art on fine quality film and have these unbelievable images. And Dion's going to talk about this today. Dion, how you doing today?
Very good. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you on the program to talk about yourself, your beautiful photography, your use of high quality, exquisite gear, and all this cool stuff you're up to.
Great.
So, Dion, let's talk about yourself. Tell me about Dion. Give me the elevator pitch, and then we'll dig deeper.
Okay. Well, from a very young age, I was exposed to art, but not necessarily photography. My father was a teacher at the Museum Art School in Portland, Oregon, and all of our friends and family friends, etc., were all artists. So I just thought everybody was an artist. So I had quite the art background. Then after getting out of school, I worked in a commercial photographic studio doing tabletop, a lot of 4x5 film work, and then it went into digital. And then right after September 11th, a lot of our work kind of went downhill. My wife was a commercial print ad producer. She also lost a lot of her clients after September 11th. So we decided to not fight it, and we sold everything in Warren, Oregon. And we moved to Eureka, Nevada, where we now live in an 1880 bank building. We moved here specifically to make art.
What was the thought process of saying, okay, well, we're going to move to Eureka, Nevada?
Well, I had done a Graphic Arts Center coffee table book on the state of Nevada, which was all shot with Hasselblad, Fuji Velvia, So we were very familiar with the state, and I was really enthralled with the landscape to begin with. So leaving the rain of Oregon was kind of a no-brainer. Found a lot of times I just couldn't get out and shoot because it was raining all the time. We'd been to Eureka several times. We liked the community, and we knew a few people here and decided to go.
No, I think it's great and very cool that you have an old bank building as well as your gallery and working space and everything all in one nice deal.
Yeah, we have a gallery and studio out front, and then we live in back all under one roof. We still have the original walk-in vault, so instead of money, it has art in it. Keep my negatives and transparencies, etc., in there for safekeeping.
So was there a lot of availability when you got to Eureka, like you guys found the old bank? Is it pretty much, the residency is down a lot there? I mean, it seems you got a really cool gig going right in the middle of town.
Real estate's actually kind of tight in Eureka due to the increase in mining activity in the area. So when we moved to town, we actually purchased a small home in town and we fixed it up. Just out of sheer luck, the fellow who happened to own this building, he wanted a house. So we just traded.
Wow, what a deal, huh?
Yeah, no, it worked out great. We're both happy.
So, Dion, tell me about how your photography has progressed over the years, starting off shooting with your dad's Hasselblad. Tell me how your photography progressed from there.
Well, I think I was looking at magazines like Audubon and Wilderness. I was really excited about nature itself and working to create images like that. And my father, the great teacher that he was, he directed me into learning to sketch and shooting black and white in the beginning to learn design elements, and held me back from shooting color at first. And then over time, I started to shoot both color and black and white. It's kind of interesting how I evolved into shooting the nature type scenes and getting that kind of wilderness society look or whatever, and then coming back to black and white. So I've gone full circle, and then leaving the total wilderness idea behind me and going on forward and finding elements of man being quite exciting to have within the image.
No, I think that's one thing that's great about your stuff, too, is you try, I think, with a lot of your work to have that element of man in this image that you're creating.
Yeah, and that really didn't happen until I started working on the Nevada book, because I kept finding like an old mine or an old ghost town or an old truck laying out in the desert. And then finding how the juxtaposition between how something of man is being gobbled back up by nature.
And I think that's definitely a place you can find it, is out where you're at, because there's a lot of open, free space.
There really is, yeah. And that's a lot of why we picked Eureka, just to be right in the center of it all, and I don't have to spend days driving to get to where I want to shoot.
Were you shooting this style of photography prior than moving to Eureka, or is it because once you got into that environment, sort of brought this out of what you wanted to shoot in these very remote locations?
Well, I started doing these panoramas during the book, and because Graphic Arts Center Book Publishing Company, they have very stringent guidelines as far as everything has to be in focus, and very stringent guidelines. It kind of took the fun out of photography in a slight way. And I found that shooting with the little plastic camera, it was a real creative outlet during that exploration. I didn't shoot that much with the plastic cameras. It was just kind of a sideline. And I was shooting while we were still living in Oregon, so I have coastal scenes and when we go out canoeing, etc. But then once we moved to Nevada, I really started shooting a lot. I mean, literally, I'll go through 100 rolls of Tri-X through these plastic cameras every couple of months.
So let's get to this whole thing about the plastic cameras that I find extremely cool and actually much different than the normal train of thought. People would think, okay, well, you got to have this large format view camera and I need this crazy over-the-top German glass. And everything's got to be laser sharp, like you said, with the graphic arts people. And tell me about chasing the almighty gear deal and the ultimate photographic equipment and then working yourself into shooting Kodak Funsaver extremely expired cameras. It's very cool.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it is the fact that they're just a piece of junk camera that makes it exciting. And I like the way that the center is relatively in focus, and then how when you get to the corners, it gets more and more out of focus. Kind of gives it a more of a dreamy look and more of a sense of an idea rather than a sense of place. And just having the two-element plastic lens in that baby, and they cost $10.95 when they're brand new.
Do you find that with these disposable cameras, like you said, it's taking you away from the whole gear thing and all the technical aspects of doing this type of fine art work, per se? and really opened you up to be more creative because you're not worried about, oh, I don't want to drop my $5,000 camera here in the weeds.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been shooting Hasselblad, which is a mechanical manual camera, and then going into this plastic camera, which is set at 125th of a second at f11. So I make my corrections in the darkroom rather than in the camera. And it's just wonderful to not spend so much time dealing with the camera function, but spending all my time thinking about aesthetics and trying to find the right scene and the right composition rather than how's the camera set, am I pushing the right button, that sort of thing.
Do you find that working with the plastic camera itself, you no longer need to worry about exposure and meters and zones? It's just like it's you and the camera and it's only going to do one thing and that's the way it goes.
Yeah, that's very true. I do try to shoot during very similar lighting situation, which can be limiting. And I do sometimes shoot different films, but Tri-X is definitely my favorite. I like Tri-X because I can pull it to 200, which is how I shoot it most of the time. Or if I get into an overcast situation or a slightly darker situation, it's quite wonderful if you push it up to 800 or so. So yeah, I mean, I'm really not dealing with the technical aspects. It's just purely looking at the aesthetics and the nature around me.
So in regards to plastic cameras and single and dual element lenses and all this fine quality injected molded goodies from China, have you played with Holgas and Dianas or even other disposable cameras? I mean, what's your range in regards to these, what you would consider, I guess, toy camera stuff?
Yeah, I've had a Holga for, 10, 12 years, and I just purchased a new one, which I like a lot better than the old one. They seem to all be different, which is quite wonderful. And I've also been experimenting with other plastic cameras and turning them into panoramic cameras because the Kodak, in time, they do die. And I started with a dozen or so in 1992, and I have four left, and I just bought a couple of them that I found on eBay from Great Britain, which is great. But I also found that the Eximus Wide and Slim, and I think it's called a Slim Black Devil camera, which has a 22mm lens, and the inserts from the Kodaks fit perfectly inside to maintain that panorama shape that I like so much for this Great Basin landscape.
Now, you modify the insert, right, to give it some rough edging, similar to the terrain you're shooting.
Yeah, it's very irregular. I started out by just taking a file to the inside of the frame. My very early versions, I thought I did it too much and found that a subtle filing was actually more appropriate. But yeah, I file it out and then I tape in a yellow gel to add a little more contrast to the image.
Now, with the style of Funsaver Kodak cameras that you're using, these are the old box square type ones that you would have seen from, what, the mid-early 90s, correct?
Correct.
Now, you can open them with a screwdriver. I guess there's like a little latch or something that was made for a lab operator to pop open.
Right.
And it's something you can rewind the film in, or you need to do this in a black bag? How does that work with sticking film in these?
Yeah, I load all my cameras in a changing tent. You have to pull all the film out of the cassette and hand roll it onto the take-up reel and then place it back into the camera and then seal it up. And then I tape it up just to ensure the light leaks aren't too bad. And then as you shoot and advance, it's pulling the film back into the cassette. So when you're at the end of the roll of film, you can just open it up in the field. It doesn't hurt anything.
Okay, so you peel all the film out till it stops and then stick the cassette in where it stopped because the film's taped to the spool inside the little metal canister, and then you wrap the rest of the film around what would be the take-up spool, and then it goes in the camera, and like you said, it shoots backwards then.
Yeah, that's correct. So yeah, it took a little bit of experimenting when I first started doing it. I was working in a commercial photo studio in Portland, Oregon, and an art director came in, and he'd seen somebody who had been shooting disposable cameras. And so I was quizzing him on, well, how do you do it? And he says, well, he doesn't really know. He just saw the stuff from a photographer. So then I found the panoramic Kodak and thought, oh, I'm going to try that. So I bought that at my local grocery store, and I actually shot the color film and wasn't too thrilled with it, and then took the camera apart and grabbed a roll of Tri-X and reloaded it.
Well, you're shooting 36 exposure, so I guess that works out fine. There's enough room in the camera because they were, what, 27 or 24 or something when they came out?
Yeah, some of them were 15 and some of them were 24s. And yeah, it's actually a little too much to put in the camera. So when my hands are still in the changing tent, I usually advance it 3 or 4 frames just so it's not so tight. When you push the clamshells back together again, it's really difficult to advance the film at first. So to prevent that, I advance it a couple times before I snap the clamshell back together. And this also helps prevent the film from getting scratched.
No, great idea. Now, have you tried playing with the other FunSaver cameras? I know they made a portrait one. They made one that had even a longer little snoot that was like their telephoto one. I mean, they had a couple different versions of these.
Yeah, I actually have a couple of the portrait ones that work terrific. The more modern ones, they've put a proprietary tooth on the film cassettes, which make it so you can't just take a roll of film without modifying the cassette to put it in. So I'm tending to stick to the older cameras.
So the newer Kodak stuff and the newer style bodies from maybe, what, mid-2000s on, the way they punch the holes in the film, I guess is made specifically for their single-use cameras.
Yeah, that's correct, which really trips you up when you're trying to reload it.
Yeah, because I guess the hole spacing is, what, wider or something? They made it the holes farther apart. I wonder why they had changed that. I guess you couldn't reuse it?
Maybe. I actually kind of found it quite annoying because I was teaching a class through the Nevada Arts Council as an artist in residence in Virginia City, and some kids brought in a modern Kodak camera, and they said, we want to reload our camera. So I took the camera in the darkroom and tried to reload it, and I was unable to because instead of the sprockets, there were notches down the side, like a serrated scissor would make.
Well, I guess if you make the film and the canisters and the camera, you can do whatever you want. So that would definitely keep people from reloading your single-use camera.
Yeah, and a friend brought by a single-use camera and said, here, found this on the street, why don't you try it out? So I took it apart, and I found it quite amusing that when I opened up the Kodak camera, it had Polaroid film in it.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, and that had the correct sprockets, but the top of the cassette didn't have the typical shape to it, so I'll have to modify a roll of film to put it in. But I think it's not too bad. I can actually figure out how to do it.
So moving forward with your gear, you found these new, and I think there's a posting on your blog site about what you've been playing with here, but these other cheapy plastic cameras have the same type of lens construction. Have you played around with any other toy cameras that are basically these little cheap things you can buy on eBay?
Yeah, actually quite a few. I found a place on eBay that sold quite a variety of plastic cameras. I tended to go towards the ones that would do panorama, or I could modify them to panorama. I really like that shape for the Great Basin landscape. But some of them were so bad that when I made my prints, they were just so out of focus and so blurry. That was not really the look that I was after. And I found that that black slim devil, and there's the white angel, Superheads makes that one. And then there's the Vivitar and the Eximus, which are all the exact identical camera. And that one modified fantastically to the panorama format and gave an extremely similar look to the Kodak. And then that way I can just load the camera and wind it back in the field. Makes it a lot simpler.
Did you find that these newer ones with a faster glass, well, I guess not much faster, but F11 to F8 made any difference in what you were shooting?
Yeah, it's actually quite amazing with 35mm and those wide-angle lenses. The F8 cameras really don't have nearly the depth of field and sharpness that some of the F11 ones. The Kodaks are F12, and quite literally, you can get everything from 2 feet to infinity as sharp as the plastic lens will allow.
So, have you found that shooting these panoramas on the plastic lens single-use cameras, that you've lost something from not going to a view camera or even an X-Pan or some higher-end thing with a nice piece of glass? Or is it really, you can't even tell when you make your prints? I think a lot of people would think like, well, why would I want to go out to these remote locations and shoot stuff with a disposable camera?
Well, it is the look. And granted, if I had an X-Pan or a Fuji 617 or something, sure, I'm going to get a lot more detail and a lot more in focus. But what I like is just the fact that it's not perfect and it adds something to the landscape that wasn't there.
Exactly. And I think, too, that everybody has an X-Pen or a 617 or some kind of monster format banquet camera they turn into a panoramic deal. And I think the landscapes that you're shooting have a very surreal, very sort of out there environment anyway. So I can see that having things that aren't super high fidelity, super sharp, over the top, it's even better with the way that you're shooting these.
Oh, yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
Now, you're using a completely hybrid process, correct? Or are you full analog?
It is a hybrid process. I'm reloading the camera with the Tri-X film, and then depending on the light, I usually pull process it in my darkroom using D76 as my chemistry one-to-one. And then after it's all said and done, I make a contact sheet for my filing purposes, and then I scan the negative on a flatbed scanner. It's an Epson V700. Then in Photoshop, I do really no more than I would if I was doing a darkroom print, which entails I burn in the center and I dodge on the outside. The nice thing about the Photoshop is that if I do get some scratch film, I can clone that out. But overall, I'm not trying to do anything different than I would in the darkroom.
Do you find that shooting a sub-size 35mm, because basically you have a 36mm wide frame, but it's whacked off, what are these, maybe 15 by 36?
Yeah, so it's an awfully small negative.
Do you find that that adds to the look of the image, or that the technology with the Epson and the V700 and the good scanning software, that there's ample information there to make the prints that you're doing?
Oh, there's a lot of information there. And I actually make scans large enough so that I can't see any pixels at all. I'm making a nearly 70-inch wide scan, and it's that lovely Tri-X grain that's coming through.
So once you've scanned this stuff and you got this into the file, now do you typically make a digital negative to do contact prints? Do you output via like an inkjet? What do you typically do once you've got everything adjusted as you would in the darkroom?
Well, right now, as a matter of fact, I'm printing a show for the Western Folklife Center, which goes up August 14th in Elko, Nevada. It's a show called Where the Cowboys Once Roamed. And that is all digital output with Hanamule Barita paper. So they really do look like a silver print with that type of paper. However, I just recently went to the Photographer's Formulary in Montana, and I learned how to make palladium platinum prints. We even went into gum bichromate and cyanotype. And in that process, we were making clear negatives with an inkjet printer and then doing contact prints from that. And that is quite lovely.
Definitely. I think the examples that you posted on your blog, I mean, this stuff's way cool looking.
Yeah.
It's really neat to be able to do this. And I think that really with analog photography moving forward, if people don't embrace some type of hybrid workflow, it's going to even start cutting down more and more on the adoption and the use of film.
Oh, absolutely. This process, to me, was so exciting to learn. The palladium platinum printing process is about 150 years old, which had a very short life due to George Eastman coming out with the Brownie camera in 1880, kind of made the palladium print process obsolete very quickly. And what I like about it is the fact that the grayscale is far greater than a silver print with a palladium print.
Yeah, this work is stunning. It's beautiful photography. And I think when people actually start digging in there and looking that I don't need to have 20 grand worth of equipment to make this kind of artwork, it changes your whole outlook on photography.
Yeah, it really does. My father was quite insightful in that when I was very young and enthralled with his Hasselblads and his Leicas and the very expensive cameras that he had, and I really strive to have all those very expensive toys. And he always said, now listen, Dion, it's 1% camera and 99% photographer, and deal with it.
Well, I think this really goes to show you your work here is spectacular, and you don't have to have the latest and greatest gear. I don't need an $8,000 digital body to do what you're doing.
Absolutely. I've had quite a few comments on my blog and website, and people are like, you did this with a $10 camera? This is incredible. And it's nice to hear that.
No, it is great. And I think that it even goes to show more of yourself and the work that you can do and your eye and how you compose and what you're doing than just saying, oh, well, he's got a Fuji 617. Anybody could go shoot that.
Right.
So I think it's great work. It's very cool.
Thank you.
And it's very unique to find someone that really wants to spend time shooting and documenting. Basically, a lot of this is a history in Nevada.
Yes.
It's very cool. A lot of people don't spend their time going out to where you're at.
No, that's partly why we moved here as well, is that there's not a lot of people living out here. And when you travel the back country out here, you are remote and you are alone. And you'd better be ready to deal with the fact that if your car breaks out there, it might be 20 or 30 miles back to the last ranch that you just passed. And finding the old relics out here and exploring all that and documenting it, I think over the years of living here, I've found the importance of documenting it. Because I've gone back to the same ranches sometimes, and they're just flat out disappearing. They're gone. There's places where there was an interesting old ranch house, and then you come and see that last winter's snow knocked it over, and it's gone. And I felt lucky that I actually was there previously, and I took photographs of it.
Do you find that going in this backcountry and doing this type of photography that you're probably a lot on dirt roads, yeah?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And you have some specific special vehicle for doing this? Anything prepped different than a regular car? What do you use that you can actually get out here without actually breaking?
Well, that is a challenge with anything that you own. We drive a 1987 Volkswagen Vanagon Synchro, which is a one-ton all-wheel drive Volkswagen bus.
I think those are pretty reliable.
Yeah, it's been pretty good. I mean, I bought it brand new, 22, 23 years ago, and it has 300,000 miles on it. And we did just recently go through some motor difficulties with it, but we believe we have that all straightened out. We're ready to head back out and start exploring again.
So really, what's the only thing that you need to take besides a decent vehicle is what, a satellite phone? So in case you break, you can get reception?
Well, a good pair of boots, and we always carry extra food, water, etc. My wife and I are both quite accomplished outdoorsmen, so we know how to camp, we know how to survive. We have had situations where the weather went south on us, and even with four-wheel drive vehicle, mud terrain tires, and both front and rear differentials locked, with hard rain on some of these mud roads, we couldn't move. I mean, we had a book and extra food and a bottle of wine, and we just waited for it to get dry, and we drove out. So we came prepared so that we didn't become a statistic.
I think, too, it's so cool that you can actually go out and just go cruise around some back road in the middle of nowhere and not have the constraints of like, well, I got to be back at work at this time. Well, I got to be back in 4 hours. Where you can actually sort of relax and just actually take in the environment to where you start building these images. It is very cool compared to a lot of people that are so tied up now with all these things going on that really distracts people from doing what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Trish and I frequently will load up the van with all of our gear, cameras, food, coolers, etc., and we'll head on out and sort of have a plan of where we want to go, but quite frequently we'll be heading down some dirt track somewhere and we'll see a road heading up over a mountain, and we both look at each other and go, what's up that road? Okay, we got to find out, and it might take us several days to figure out what's up there, how do we document it. We'll find a nice camp somewhere, and sometimes if we find a nice camp, the car will just sit there for several days, and then we'll hike and stuff from a base camp.
And you use GPS and all this kind of stuff, or no? You just sort of go wherever it goes, and that's it?
Yeah, well, we keep good maps with us, and I do have a GPS now, but that's a new phenomenon for me, and that has helped quite a bit.
Do you find that the GPS actually shows these dirt roads that roll off in the middle of nowhere?
Absolutely not. No, they're not on there at all. So I use the GPS in conjunction with a benchmark book map, so I can find my coordinates on the map and see where I am.
Cool. Dion, let's talk about your book stuff. You did this book about Nevada, named Nevada. Very, very cool book. I know that Graphic Arts Center went belly up and Ingram has the stuff now. How's the book thing going?
Actually, pretty darn good. We went through a period where Graphic Arts Center was having financial difficulties and I didn't get royalties for quite a while. But Ingram did take over, and they paid us back a percentage, not the full amount, of back royalties. Now they're a pretty solvent company. I've recently been given a royalty check, and it was the full amount. The book, we have 495 left in the warehouse. I have 90 here in my gallery, and that's out of 10,300 that were printed back in 2001.
So are you looking to do a new version of the book? Is there stuff that you want to put into a different book? What's your publishing site looking forward? What are you going to do?
John Christensen, the writer of the Nevada book, and I are talking about creating a new Nevada book. We have a few ideas bouncing around, and you're probably not going to like to hear this, but I'm shooting for the color work where it needs to be sharp and crisp and everything. It's all Canon 5D digital whiz-bang stuff.
Well, you know, it's a commercial job, so you need to use a tool that is correct for what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I look at all cameras, if they're digital or if they're film or whatever. It's just you're using the appropriate tool for the appropriate results that you're looking for.
Exactly.
In the new Nevada book, we actually are going to use the plastic panorama images as headers between the chapters that we're going to create.
No, that's great to see some of that work get into the book. The Nevada book is mainly images. Is there a lot of text in it? Tell me how you guys split between what your writer did and what you shot. How did you guys balance the two out, or is it more photography than text, or how's that?
It's a photographic coffee table book. See, I think it's 140 pages, and there's probably 130 photographs. So 10 pages of text with small photographs to separate the written idea that John Christensen wrote.
So out of all the places in Nevada that you've been to, because you've been to some really wild, crazy, out-of-location places, what's your favorite place in Nevada?
Oh, boy, that's tough. There's so many just absolutely terrific places. There's so many locations along US 50, and that's, here again, another reason that we moved to Eureka, which is right along the loneliest road in America. But within just minutes of this location, I can be, say, like Hamilton Mountain, where there's a dozen ghost towns that very few people get out and explore, or up in the northwest corner of Nevada around the Black Rock and some of those outlying areas there that even fewer people explore. That's kind of what Trish and I like to get out and do, is just go places that few people see.
It's amazing that there is so many ghost towns, like you said, outside of the area where you're at that aren't a tourist attraction. It's not the Ponderosa Ranch gig. It's just there, and it just died.
Yeah. Last weekend, Trish and I drove over to Berlin Ichthyosaur State Park, which is a nice ghost town and everything, but it's a little contrived, and they've fixed stuff up, and they've hauled equipment in to make it look like a ghost town. And all the time I was there shooting, I was really thinking how much more interesting a place like Belmont Mill or Hamilton. It's a lot more exciting to visit those places because it's real, and sure, people have vandalized and stolen things out of it, but at least it was pretty much the way it was when they left.
Virginia City is an interesting location, and interesting to see how you have all the old stuff in Virginia City married with new, and it's an interesting place.
Yes, it is. I did an artist in residency with the Nevada Arts Council there for the month of January several years ago, and it was really fun to live in the town for a whole month and really got out and explored the little nuances that when you're a tourist and you drive into town and look at all the exciting things that you miss a lot. And spending a whole month there opened up those opportunities.
Yeah, the graveyard is fabulous there.
Oh, it really is. I think half the film that I shot was probably shot in the cemetery.
Did you find that when you guys were out trucking around that you run across other cemeteries, graveyards out in the middle of nowhere?
Oh, yeah. Just some real gems show up and you don't even realize they're there. A lot of times they're not even on the map and you're just bouncing down some dirt road and, oh, what's this? Oh, it's an old cemetery. Well, that's kind of neat. So you stop and shoot some film and explore it and back on the road again.
So what are you looking forward to do with your photography moving forward? So you've been trucking around and shooting this cool stuff in Nevada. Is it time to go to different places? What do you look forward to? What do you guys want to do that you haven't got to do yet?
Well, there's always more states around the West, but I do love Nevada a lot. And it is a really exciting place that can take several lifetimes to explore everything that's out there. I'm continuing to push the classic panorama idea out there. And having just done this workshop on the platinum palladium prints, they are definitely going to evolve into the old-fashioned printing techniques to bring a preciousness and a unique, one-of-a-kind print final product.
Now, let's talk about your work. You have lots of shows, the stuff's in galleries. Tell me about how that's working out.
I typically try to have 4 to 6 gallery venues a year. Most in recent history have been in the state of Nevada. A lot of it is through Sierra Arts. They're galleries that they don't really own them, but they're managing venues around the Reno-Carson area. But then just recently, I have been doing portfolio reviews. I did Photo Lucida in Portland last year. And then I did Photo Fest in Houston just last March. Photo Fest was more international. Photo Lucida was more national. And out of that, I ended up with a show at the Rayco Center in San Francisco, and then a show in Austin, Texas at the Watkins Gallery. And they were all venues that were showing off the plastic cameras.
Do you find that people want to put your work in with other Lomo, lo-fi, Holga-ish type stuff? Or do they usually typically look at it because of the body of work and not so much how it's shot?
Both. The shows that I ended up getting from being at Portfolio Reviews, those were group shows that were showing off the lo-fi camera idea. But then when I've visited galleries, they're just looking at it for the pure aesthetic art sense of it. And quite frankly, they don't care how it was made. They just think it's beautiful and think it's sellable, and they want to hang it.
It's very cool to see people want to put the work up and show it like it is, and not so much saying, okay, well, we're going to stick you into an envelope of here's the plastic people, and you can look at their stuff. But I guess any gallery showing and any way you can be exposed to the public's great, but always cool to see people hanging your work on the body of work itself, but not so much putting you into a classification as plastic camera deal.
Right, yeah, that's exciting. The show that will hang in August in Elko at the Western Folklife Center, I'll be one of 3 photographers that will be up from August 14th to December 14th. Very long show. But it's interesting because there's one photographer who I believe he is from Arizona or New Mexico, and he's been documenting ranch gates And then there'll be another photographer that has been documenting Western ranch architecture. And then my aspect, which is where the cowboys once roamed, which is kind of a decay of the ranching lifestyle. It will be three very different looks and very different ideas, yet they're still all about ranching in the West.
Yeah, this is pretty cool stuff. Dion, let's talk about where people can look at your blog, your website, where your stuff's going to be in studios and galleries, and where they can just look at this fabulous photography. Because they really need to look at this work and not really concentrate on that it's made with any kind of equipment. Just look at it for itself. It is very cool.
Well, my website is www.deonreynolds.com. That's DEONREYNOLDS.com. The blog is deonreynolds.wordpress.com. Right now, probably the best place to look at my work is to come on out to Eureka, Nevada and come visit me. I have a gallery that's open from Tuesday through Saturday, 11 to 5 p.m., right on Main Street, right in Eureka, Nevada. It's the only gallery in town, so you really can't miss us. And if you blink too much going through, you'll miss Eureka.
So how far is Eureka from, let's say, Carson City or Reno?
It's 240 miles east on US 50.
And I'm sure if someone's going to make the drive out, there's some interesting things to see along the way.
Oh boy, there really is. I never tire of that drive. We drive every 6-8 weeks into Carson to stock up on supplies, hit the Costco and Trader Joe's, etc., and load up the van full of food. I've driven it in all seasons and any time of the day, and it's always an exciting and wonderful drive.
Yeah, it's a great place, and I really appreciate it. Dion joins today talking about your fabulous photography and all this great work you're doing. It's really cool. It's fresh. It's nice to see photography and art like this that's not tied down to the latest and greatest in digital technology or some special German lenses for my large format camera, that you can actually make and do beautiful artwork with basically tossed away cameras. And you're an exact proof of it really doesn't matter about the camera. It's about the photographer.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, there you go. Dion Reynolds, what a cool guy. Beautiful photography out in Eureka, Nevada, doing these panoramic photographs with single-use and cheap plastic cameras. You know, it really goes to show you that you can have a $10,000 lens and this old sacred view camera. Or you know something? You can use an old throwaway Kodak panoramic camera. Or you can hack anything that's plastic, but guess what? A Holga, it doesn't matter. It's about your vision and making this great photography, and guess what? Dion's got it. It's cool stuff. Definitely check out Dion's website, of course, over at www.deonreynolds. That's DEONREYNOLDS.com. DeonReynolds.com. Check out this beautiful documentary, fine art photography from the American West. It's great stuff. You definitely need to check it out. The Inside Analog Photo Radio Program has been brought to you by Fujifilm for their full line of instant cameras and film, and of course, fine quality Fuji Crystal Archive paper over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. Our friends at Photo Publicist, worldwide publicity, strategic promotion, social media marketing, and business development over at www.photopublicist.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab for the finest quality lab in the country, richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at DR5 for black and white chrome at dr5.com. Upstrap for the finest quality camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder at upstrap-pro.com. Our friends over at Iger Studios at igerstudios.com. And of course, our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group at apug.org and our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House, over at eastmanhouse.org. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photo. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.